Blog Talk Radio.
That wasn't supposed to do that. I like starting it out with that song I had written years ago, and because a lot of the things that happen, they want us to believe their lies. They want us to have sympathy for sickness and diseases of messing with children or doing other hate crimes continues if we just turn a blind eye. All right, I will read our main mission statement. Abuse affects our lives in so many ways. What do we do when we are too scared to tell? When we have trusted someone and they did not help. Sometimes someone asks, what did you do to get punished this way? Abuse is abuse. Abuse is not punishment. Abuse is torture, crippling, and debilitating. What advice would you give others to help them through the horrendous memories? Are you there for the person, or are you part of the knife in your friend or relative's back, since you may have turned a blind eye to it? Are you claiming to advocate against abuse but condemn the people who tell and share their stories? Do you want to be a part of the solution or part of the problem? Let's stand united and discuss ways in which we may help others. What ways have helped you in your healing journey? Are you in a constant battle fighting the negative forces within? Stop it. Let's encourage one another. Are you an officer in the judicial system not doing your job to help the victim? That means you're not doing your duty. Your duty is to serve and protect. How do we open the public's eyes so that they can acknowledge and feel the need to help protect the children and our citizens? The children are our future. You matter. Okay, today, our guest is Blackstone Lawyer, who's a survivor of Bentley Farms since 1972. He shares his horrendous knowledge of the corruption that was first directed at him since he was 6 years old, but he's got an earlier tale from the very beginning. So without further ado, welcome, Blackstone Lawyer.
Well, hello, Ms. Darlene. How are you?
I'm doing better than Midland. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. A little windy, a little cool, breezy, but, you know, other than that, still hanging in there like a loose tooth and looking forward to getting that word-of-the-mouth advertisement going again and hoping we can get a lot of people educated and get the awareness spread, because that's the only way to really battle this pandemic of child abuse is awareness.
Yes.
I've learned that, you know, we can legislate laws, but if those laws are not enforced on certain people like they are on everyone else, then there is lawlessness. There is no justice in this country, and where the American people are starting to see that now.
Yes.
But I guess my story really begins before Bentley Farms. I was a developer builder's brat. My dad, he did most of his developing in Cobb County and South Cherokee County, Georgia. He started in between the mid and late 1960s until he took on a stucco contract down in Naples, Florida, and decided to move the family down there in the latter part of 1968, where he could work with his brother on this huge building to do stucco work, and until he had an automobile accident where they had to take, you know, two discs out of his back and fused two of them together, and he was in bed for almost 2 years. But while we were living in Naples, I still have my memory about my first encounter with a predator in the form of an ice cream truck driver. And I had some neighbors that husband and wife worked. They didn't have children, so sometimes I would just go over and stand under their carport because we didn't have much of a carport, but they did, and I'd go over, and they were fine with it. They didn't have a problem with a three-year-old boy coming over and, you know, hanging out under their carport, so I had their permission. And unlike all the other ice cream trucks that used to come through, this one came through one day, didn't have its music playing, bell ringing, or anything like that.
Very suspicious.
The guy driving it, ma'am?
Very suspicious.
Yes, ma'am. And he just pulled up there to the driveway, hollered at me and said, "Hey, little boy, would you like some free ice cream?" And I was like, no thank you, or something like that. And he was persistent. He kept saying, "Well, come on out here. I'll give you some free ice cream." And I still stuck to what my mother and grandparents had told me, do not accept, you know, candy and ice cream from strangers.
Right.
So I was really listening to them. I didn't care if he was an ice cream truck driver. I was not going out there to his van and getting free ice cream. And he was still persistent, like really trying to get me out there to his van. And my mom took notice that he was parked right there in front of both driveways, and she walked to the door. And she hollered out him to leave the little boy alone. And he goes, "Lady, that's not your son, and you need to mind your own business." And she goes, "That is too my son, and I am calling the police."
Wow.
So the police came. It was very strange that this ice cream truck driver, which was his route, he had just been hired by the ice cream company. He had been given some ice cream to a little girl down the street that was a little bit older than me. And if I remember correctly, she eventually went missing herself.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But it was his ice cream route for a little while. One day, my siblings, you know, I'm the baby of the family of four, and we all had to walk down to this intersection in the neighborhood where all the other children would, you know, wait to get their ice cream. So he had two lines. He had a line for children who had never received free ice cream, which was longer than the line than the ones who had already received it, and their parents were there paying for it. And, of course, my siblings got their ice cream before I did. And when I came up, it was like, "Well, you don't get free ice cream. I offered you free ice cream last week, so you don't get free ice cream." And that kind of upset my mom. My mom was like, "What do you mean he doesn't get free ice cream just because he wouldn't accept it from you before?" And even some of the other mothers, not all, but some of the other mothers were like, "Do what?" You know, you're talking about this little boy who wouldn't accept your ice cream because you were a stranger, and you're not going to give him free ice cream because of that. And they told their youngest, "Let's go. We'll take you to the store, and I'll get your ice cream there." So regardless to say, he wasn't on that route very long, and I really think it was something to do with a girl down the street who went missing. And that was really what I believe was my first encounter with a pedophile. He could have been any more than 18, 19 years old, you know, blonde hair, more sandy hair guy, kind of skinny. So he couldn't really been over 18, 19 years old. And that was really my first thing, what I believe was my first encounter with one of these type of people.
Wow.
So after my dad recovered from his surgery, he wasn't going to be able to do stucco work again, so he wound up moving us back to Marietta, Georgia.
Yeah, from Naples, Florida, right?
Yes, ma'am. He had moved us to Naples from Marietta, and he wound up moving back to Marietta. And he went up to Woodstock, Georgia, there at Highway 5 and 92, and he bought three corners of that intersection, and he got the land zoned commercial, and he turned around and sold it. He made a passel of money on it, so he started just buying land all over East Cobb County and getting it zoned for residential and out there just building developments all over the place. He also did building, which he did a lot of building with his friends. Even my mother's brother even got into building with him. And he was an employee for the water department for Cobb County. He used to work the prisoners out there on the county farm for the water department. He got into building with him. And so he just, you know, like a couple of years, he's just, you know, well, not even a couple of years, just like within a year, he's the largest developer in Cobb County. So he was out here running ahead of this other developer builder by the name of Ed Bentley Sr., who on this farm, they're on the 120 loop. They're in Marietta. A lot of people who are familiar where White Water is, they're north of the Big Chicken. This is the exit that you take to get to White Water off of Interstate 75. So if you don't go toward Cobb Parkway, you turn the other direction and you go out to the intersection of Wallace Road and what we know is North Marietta Parkway. Ed Bentley Jr. owns all that real estate and buildings all between Wallace Road and Roswell Road right there in Marietta, including the commercial buildings on Greenbrier Parkway and Roswell Road, including Waffle House Unit 479. He owns that building and leases it to the Waffle House Corporation.
That's like a pretty big area.
It is. And back then, this was before they extended Interstate 75 from Allgood Road up to Dalton, Georgia, which opened up the interstate there and just caused Atlanta to boom once they opened up that 80-mile stretch of highway right there. And once they opened that up, it just businesses just started moving in and the place just started booming. And that's when the boost of metropolitan Atlanta really began, was in 1978, 1979, once they got that stretch of interstate completed.
Yeah, but I remember when Atlanta was not as big like that on the traffic. Back in the early 70s, it was easier. It didn't seem like it was so much traffic. It didn't seem as congested like it is today.
Yeah, it was so there was so little traffic that Georgia Governor Lester Maddox got on his bicycle and rode it backwards. They're on Interstate 285 one day because there just really wasn't that much traffic that he could get there and ride his bicycle backwards as a fundraiser, a political stunt. And that was another one of my dad's buddies was Lester Maddox. He was governor of Georgia before Jimmy Carter.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But he and my dad, they did quite a bit of business dealings together through the years, you know, afterwards. And he wasn't governor when the stuff went down up in Morganton, Georgia, 1975. But what had happened was my dad had this heavy equipment operator who worked for him, and he really didn't want anybody else working for him. You know, when you're a developer builder and you get a good, reliable, heavy equipment operator, you really don't want anybody else really working for you when they're reliable and they're skilled and stuff like that. But he was waiting on the permits for Frankie Lane and Pine Shadows subdivision off of Poly Springs Road when he completed his developments over off of Trickham Road and Shalford Road and Jamerson Road, where he gone in and did a huge development over there in like three different neighborhoods. Some that he had previously developed and built before he moved us to Naples, Florida to do, you know, take that contract for the stucco work. So he thought it would be a month to maybe 6 weeks before he would get his permits to start his other, you know, two developments he was wanting to start. But really turned into about a 2 week period.
Wow.
Well, of course, he was paying his heavy equipment operator money, you know, to pay his bills, put groceries on the table until he got his other permits to start his, you know, two developments. But his operator went and took a contract with a builder, left him with a vacancy when he got his permits, and you know, when you're a developer and you got a loan at a bank and you're sitting there waiting to start a development, you're losing money. You're not, you're definitely not making it. You're actually losing money if you're not getting in there and breaking ground and getting everything done on schedule and meeting your notes to the bank. So back then, you know, contractors in the area at that time, there was only two places. Back then they would meet in Marietta for coffee and breakfast, and one was at the Dunaway Drugs on the Marietta Square, and another one was at the Dunkin' Donuts on Roswell Road across from the Town and Country Shopping Center and, well, New London Shopping Center as well, there where Williamson Brothers Barbecue is located today. So he would go in the mornings, and he would ask some of the other contractors if they knew any heavy equipment operators. And Ed Sr. heard him one morning talking with some other contractors, and he recommended his son-in-law, Jim Stubbs, who was an experienced heavy equipment operator since he was in the Army Corps of Engineers.
When you said Ed Sr., is this Ed Bentley Sr.?
Yes, you have Ed Bentley and Ed Bentley Jr. You know, Ed Sr.'s dad and Jr.'s still alive. So, yeah, that's Ed Sr. When I say Ed Sr., it's Ed Bentley.
Okay. Just try to elaborate for the listeners.
Mm-hmm. But anyway, my dad never was really too fond of Mr. Bentley. He just, it was just something my dad never would say, that he really, really, really didn't give the guy much credence. But he kept going in the Dunkin' Donuts, you know, 2-3 mornings out of a week. And the more he went in, Ed would bend, you know, Ed would taunt him. Well, you know, I told you about my son-in-law there, you know. You know, he's about to become a police officer for Cobb County, and he can use the extra money since you need somebody temporarily, because Jim Stubbs, his son-in-law, had, in fact, applied to become a Cobb County police officer. And according to Ed Sr., he had already been accepted and was just waiting for his place to start at the academy, which was not true. His application was still pending, but it was later denied. So, you know, he was depicted as this fine Christian man who took his family to church every Sunday morning, didn't even drink, was a devoted husband to his wife and family. And there was nothing about that that was true at all. What we found out after his arrest in 1972 was when he was working out in Louisiana for oil companies doing grading out there, he was carousing on his wife, come home Friday evenings, clean up, and say he was going out to the bar with the boys and stuff like that, and he was out having affairs on his wife and them with three children. Then he wound up having an affair with one woman that he wound up sexually abusing her 9-year-old daughter.
Oh, my.
Well,
that was a Stubbs. That was the Stubbs one, right?
Ma'am?
So that was Stubbs. That was his son-in-law,
yes,
right? Ed Bentley Sr.'s,
yes, ma'am,
son-in-law.
Yes, ma'am. And actually, that wasn't his biological daughter. That was his niece who he had adopted after her parents had got killed in an automobile accident back in 1953.
Wow.
Well, I had spoke with her back in 1998 after I came back down from Murphy, North Carolina, and went over there to her house when I found out where she lived. And I went over there and visited with her, and this is how I was able to find this out from her. But I think the couple married in 1961 or 1962, because after she graduated Sprayberry High School, she wanted to get out of the abusive situation that she endured by her uncle after he adopted her, which started at when she was 10 years old.
So he was essaying her himself, right?
Yes, ma'am. And so she leached on to the first, you know, adult male that she could leech on to and try to settle down, you know, be a housewife, have a normal family, a normal life for the change. And she wound up marrying a monster just like, and it was terrible because you're talking, you know, a member of the Ku Klux Klan. And his theory was, well, you married him. You are not divorcing him. It is death until you part. So she was stuck in a marriage until one of them had to die, is what it boiled down to. There was no divorce as far as her adopted dad was concerned. She married [S2]
Right. [S1]
Him, and she was stuck with him. So he knew about the abuse that she endured, you know, during the first years of their marriage when he got physically abusive with her. Her family knew it, and her family didn't do anything about it. I mean, she went from one abuser to another's what it boiled down to. So they wound up having three children. I think Jeff was like my sister's age, which is like almost 3 years or almost 4 years older than me. I guess I'm making my oldest brother's age, Bill. And then his other son was like to my older brother's, Fred's age. And their daughter, if I remember correctly, Marissa, she was like 8 months younger than me at 5 years of age when I was six.
People probably wondering whether or not her parents that had died in Rick, whether they were good parents or whether they were like Ed Sr.
It's just hard to say because when you have experiences like I have with these people and having an older brother that got involved with them, and as many a times as I've almost been killed by these people, including my own older brother, it really does make you wonder.
Yes.
But what it boiled down to, my dad's a large developer. He was competing against Ed Bentley. And so Ed determined the solution for that was to target the two youngest children of my dad and try to lure us into where he could produce some child pornographic material and try to set my dad up and frame him for it to get him sent to prison. So when his equipment operator took on the contract for this builder, which is, you know, kind of suspicious to me today, but, you know, may not have had anything to do with it for all I know, but I just know there was that, you know, vacancy that my dad became desperate and needing a heavy equipment operator and did wind up hiring Jim Stubbs to run heavy equipment for him until his other operator could come back to work. And he was in the impression that he had already been accepted by the police department and that he was going to go to work to become a police officer. And it was just a temporary position, a temporary employee. It was not permanent. So I, before he hired him, I had come down with my second bout of double pneumonia. It was a very deadly bout. They didn't think I was going to survive. Instead of putting me in the hospital, there was this clinic up in Woodstock, Georgia, off of Arnold Mill Road, Bodie Medical Clinic. And the doctor, I can't remember his first name, but his name was Dr. Bodie. And he had this little clinic that provided the same, you know, care as a hospital. It had their ICU unit where nurses would monitor the patients 24/7. It was built in a circle, so the nurses' station was in the center of the building, and they could tend to the people in the room surrounding the center. But they also had other rooms that provided regular care without, you know, being closely monitored, which,
right,
of course, the second with double pneumonia I had, I wasn't in the ICU, but I was in a regular room. So when I went in at my first deadly bout, he was still looking for a heavy equipment operator. And I remember him telling me about the guy that was recommending this one man for him he wasn't going to consider. Then he turned around and one day told me he was going to consider hiring him. And that's what he did. He wound up hiring Jim Stobbs. Well, I had my first near-death experience, and I came back on this mission. That's all I'm going to get into that. And supposed to have my first encounter with the devil, and the devil was Jim Stobbs. So when I came back, it was like I didn't have pneumonia. It shocked the nurses. It shocked Dr. Bodie. They couldn't believe it. I was allowed to go home that morning as I didn't have any symptoms of pneumonia. They couldn't believe it. It was like I'd been in the ICU, but the next day it was like I didn't even have pneumonia, if that makes
completely
any
healed,
sense.
Huh?
So that was completely healed. So we got home. I was told just to go to bed and just rest in bed for a day. And next morning, I could go outside, you know. Then in the spring, and I could go outside and play and the next day. So that's what I did, was take it easy that morning when I got home. The following morning, I woke up to the sound of a front end loader breaking ground on Frankie Lane there next door to the house where we were living.
And you were how old?
Six years old.
Okay, thank you.
So I got up and got my breakfast, and my dad was standing outside, you know, watching, you know, the front end loader operator do his thing, who was Mr. Stubbs. So I went out there and stood with him. I don't remember. I think it was his friend David Laird who was there with him, another builder, watching him break ground, wanted to come by and pop in and visit with me since I got out of the hospital. And so we got to sit there and talk a few minutes while watching this guy, you know, cut in the first, I guess, maybe 15 foot of the road. Well, we had this old house that was next door, this old oak tree he wound up pushing down. Well, my dad allowed me to ride on the front end loader with him. And when you're up on one of those machines and you're talking to people on the ground, they can't hear what it's being said.
Right.
So first thing he did, he was real friendly. He was real nice. You know, he seemed like this big teddy bear type guy that would, you know, putting on like he was my new friend and about to become a police officer and had children my age, he would love me to meet. They would be my new friends. So he started the grooming process from the very moment that I sat in his lap to ride on that machine while he was, you know, cutting in Frankie Lane.
Little did your daddy know that either, you know?
No, he was clueless. You know, he really didn't start out with him with a lot of trust, but he didn't have any reason to distrust him because, you know, he was under this false impression that, you know, he was like him, you know, family, and, yeah, he's about to become police officer, so that was a plus in his book, so that kind of broke his guard down a little bit there. But still not enough to really, for him to feel totally safe with the guy, you know, because he didn't know him, and he knew he was, you know, well experienced, and from what he was seeing, he was really talented heavy equipment operator, and which of course he would be, being an Army Corps of Engineers. And so that wasn't the only development that they were doing. There was Pine Shadows they broke ground on across the road. Then they went over and finished the second phase of Sandy Plains Estates, and I got to ride on heavy equipment there with him. And one day he had his wife bring their children out with some lunch and stuff, and we all broke, and I got to meet the children and his wife. And, you know, they seemed like a normal couple, normal family. The children were nice, and but we didn't get to talk long, and we got back and went to work, and I got to ride my dad on one of those big dirt pans. And when I wasn't riding with him, I was, you know, riding with Mr. Stubbs. And it was, you know, the whole process was, you know, gaining my trust.
Right.
It was when he got out of the academy, he got his patrol car. He would come by sometimes and would pick me up and take me out on patrol with him. And that was his promises, you know. Oh, yeah, I'll let you go. I'll even come by sometime and get you. You can ride out with me while I'm on patrol. You know, when you're a six-year-old boy, you know, you're like, oh, cool. Yeah, I'm going to get to ride in a, you know, front of a police car with an officer while he's on patrol, you know. And,
exactly.
Yeah, and you're not going to think anything bad because, one, you don't know what sex is about. You don't even know really what abuse is at that age. I mean, you're still, you know, only been in this world 6 years, so you really don't have much knowledge about what's out here in this world. You're just a little kid, and that's how it was targeted, and that was who was targeting me, was his father-in-law. He was doing this for him and his father-in-law. So one week, he even went as far to tell my dad he had to take that week and go through his training. It convinced my dad that on the weekends he was taking some training, but he had some special arrangements to where he could go in and receive some of his training and stuff. And he hadn't even been accepted. You know, it was a bunch of hogwash. He wound up purchasing, and I think it was a 1970 Ford Fairlane commissioned patrol car. Still had the decals. Still had the little single blue light on the roof. I don't think it had the little cage thing in it. I don't think the 1960s models did. Now, I think they came out with those later in the 1970s. But he managed to borrow a pair of trousers and a shirt from two officers. So one day he drove over to our house in this decommissioned patrol car, pretending to be out there working with the police. My oldest brother and I was there when he came by, just to show me that he was, you know, working that week with the police, that it wasn't going to be long. He was going to be a police officer, and then I'd be able to ride with him in a new patrol car, and he would have his badge, his gun, and all the stuff that he didn't have. He didn't even have police radio. But it was enough to really enthuse me to want to come and spend the night with him and his family, because that was the whole thing, was, you know, groom me into coming and spending the night with his family.
Right.
And now back then they used to have these concrete horse stalls you could see from 120 Loop. You couldn't help but miss them. I mean, they were out there plain as day. And at the ends closest to the road, the one to the right had a four-bedroom living quarters where the ranch hands would live. Then adjacent to it in the other concrete stables was a game room that had a air hockey table, ping pong table, and a dartboard. You know, so the people who was working on the ranch have a game room they could go over and do stuff recreational when they weren't working. Well, that's where they wound up moving the family to after they located Terry and the children through a private investigator in 1971. And what had happened was when she found out that he sexually abused the 9-year-old girl, she confronted him about it. And he got outraged. He started beating on her. The two sons tried to come in and defend her. You know, of course they would. And the neighbors heard the commotion, so they called the police. They come out and they arrest him for what we call today domestic violence and cruelty to children. Judge grants her a protective order for her and the children against him. She files for divorce. So she moved around 40 miles away to another town to where she could still drive and show up to his court appearances. But she was very reluctant. No, this is before this one. This is one to get you caught up to why they were living there, where they were living.
Okay.
So she made a mistake. Just before Thanksgiving in 71, she called one of her aunts just to check up to see how her uncle or adopted dad was doing. She didn't think they would tell where she was at, that she could trust them. Come to find out, she had senior where she was at. He hired a private investigator out of Louisiana who went up there and located her and the children, called him back and gave them the location. So he sent Ed Jr. out there with Jim. Ed arrived, knocked on the door. She let Ed in. And Ed walked out and let Jim in and stood outside while he nearly beat her to death.
Wow.
She was only given one of two options: kill her then, or she could be a loyal wife and support everything that he was doing. If he killed her, he would go ahead and still rape their daughter, or he could let her live, and he would wait till after she turned 5 to rape her.
Wow.
That's the options that Terry was given. So, of course, when you're a mother, you hear that out of a husband like that, what's your options? You're not going to want anything bad to happen to your children. You sure don't want to die because you can do nothing for them if you're dead. So, of course, that was her option. They brought her back to Marietta, moved her and the children into those quarters for the ranch help, where they could keep an eye on her. And that's where her and the children were living, to where they could not escape that farm. So unbeknownst to my dad, you know, he thought he was working an individual that was upstanding. And I forgot to mention he was also suspected of a disappearance of a 7-year-old boy in Mississippi, if I remember correctly. It was either Louisiana or Mississippi. He was a suspect in another boy's disappearance. So Cobb County, finding out he was still under investigation, did not accept his application. So he had applied again, and it was still pending, but he had never been accepted for employment by the Cobb County Police Department, like Ed Bentley had led my dad to believe. So my parents went against their better judgment. They allowed me to go and spend the night over there on Bentley Farm with the Stubbs family. And I got over there and met the children again. I got to sit in the patrol car for a minute or two and just check things out. But I was always asking too many questions, so he really didn't want me in the car too long. So he'd much rather have me out in the game room playing with the children. And one of the conditions, or I'm going to say two of the conditions that he was told that I could spend the night was, one, I did not bathe with any of his children. Two, I would sleep in a bed in a room by myself, not in a room with the other children. And, you know, of course, you know, feed me breakfast and bring me back home before 11 o'clock in the morning. Well, that wasn't the plan. I was being groomed on the way over there about taking a bath with his daughter. So when I arrived and got out to the game room playing with the children, the sons were like, oh, hey, you going to bathe with our sister tonight? And, you know, really pumping me up that I'm about to have an experience of my life that is like no other, and I would have the most fun I had ever had in my life if I was just to take a bath with her, like they had taken a bath with her. Because after he had sexually abused her, he had her doing it with her brothers.
Sicko.
Yes, ma'am. So here I was being groomed by him, then being groomed by the children. So he called us in for supper. We went in and sat down at the dinner table. So right after the family says the blessing, because I was used to, you know, the family saying the blessing, you know, before eating. So they, you know, he said a blessing. So when he said the blessing, he looked at me and he asked me if I was going to bathe with his daughter that night. And something told me I better tell him yes. So I told him I would, and he just kind of smirked at me. He goes, it's a good thing you just said yes, Charles, because you know what I was about to do if you said no? I was like, no. He goes, I would snatch you up and taken you outside and beat you in the head with a shop hammer and told your parents that you ran off.
Wow. Anybody wants to call in to support him or ask him any questions, you can call 563-999-3517. Again, the number is 563-999-3517.
Yeah, so regardless to say, I wound up with a tub with a girl about 8 months younger than me, teaching me things that little girls and little boys that age should not know and should be taught at such a young age. Questioned her about how she knew this stuff. And she told me that her daddy had done it to her. And this was after Ed Sr. and Jr. came over right after we got in the tub and they peeped in the door at us, that she started, you know, having me do these things to her, and she started doing these things to me, and I started asking her how she learned this stuff. And when she said that, it upset him. He had me to get out of the tub immediately and got me dressed and put me to bed. And we got up the next morning, had our breakfast. He took a different route home, the longer way around. And before our arrival, he looked at me in his rearview mirror and told me that if I ever wanted to come back and spend the night with him and his family, I would not tell anyone about the bath, about what had happened in the bathtub or anything to that nature. And I better not tell any of my siblings, any of my friends at school or church, cousins, aunts or uncles or anyone, because if I did and my dad found out, he would kill him. So when he arrived at our house and I got out, my mom asked him how it was. I was this ideal boy. I was perfect. The family loved him. They looked forward to having me back over again, just like everything was normal. And I couldn't say a word out of fear that he would kill my daddy.
Exactly.
I had forgotten. I did go back over there one time on a Saturday, and they were trying to get her and me to go to this barn where they could take pictures of what they wanted us to do, and I wouldn't do it. And, of course, my dad came over, and he wound up picking me up and taking me back home, and that was my only two encounters over there on that farm. Well, while he was working in the Pine Shadows, I really didn't feel keen about riding on heavy equipment with Mr. Stubbs after this, but I did get on the front end loader with him one more time. And while we were up there, I can't remember exactly what it was he said, but he reminded me what would happen if I was to ever say anything to my dad. That even if my dad had any suspicions, that he would kill him. And after he said that, I had him to let me off of the heavy equipment, and I would never get back on the loader with him again, which was a red flag to my dad.
Exactly.
Before that, here I had this new friend, you know, heavy equipment operator, and all of a sudden, I no longer wanted to get on the heavy equipment and ride with him again. I didn't even want to go to a job and be left with him again without my dad, and that was just a red flag. So what I think happened was my dad got with my older brother and told him just to see what he could get out of me about what happened over there at the overnight stay, because for about 2 weeks he would keep bringing it up, not on a daily basis, but, you know, when we'd be out playing in this old Ford automobile my dad had. He had, like, I think it was like a 48 Ford sedan that had the suicide doors. We used to love to play and, like, we were gangsters and stuff like that because of the suicide doors. And one day I broke down and told my brother in confidence, as long as he didn't tell anybody how I had knowledge about certain things about the female anatomy. So once he told me he wouldn't tell anybody, I told him about what I had learned from Marissa Stubbs, and he immediately ran in and told our mother, who in turn called my paternal grandmother's house and had her to get my dad in touch with her as soon as possible. Of course, he came over, and I had to tell him the same stuff that I had told her. And he goes, well, I'm going to go have a talk with him. I was like, no, Daddy, you can't let him know you know anything about it or he will kill you. And he was like, he told you that? I'm like, well, yes, sir. He goes, well, look at me in the eye and tell me that again, that Mr. Stubbs said he would kill me. I said, yes, Mr. Stubbs said he will kill you. He leaned back in his chair, and he was like, well, thank you, son, for letting me know that. I know what approach I need to do about this now. Well, he had this friend who was a police officer named Bill Galloway. So he contacted Bill. Ma'am?
Your dad had the friend?
Yes, ma'am. My dad had a friend on the police department. Yes, ma'am. He had had a brother who was a sheriff's deputy in the 60s who died from a heart attack, who was a deputy for Cobb County. A year after this, I had a cousin on my mother's side who went to work for Cobb County Police and was also involved in the Atlanta child murders. But he was adopted. He wasn't blood kin. He was a step cousin and my uncle, the one who built houses with my dad, and actually the brother of the sister my dad named Frankie Lane after was actually after Robert's sister. And so he got with Bill Galloway. He got with his superiors. My dad went out and he finished the job. He set everything up. We went to my grandmother's house for the rest of the day until he lined everything up. Then just about after 6 o'clock, he had us all back home with my aunt, sitting in his office with her two pistols. There was this church next door, with cemetery where the vehicles that everybody else was driving parked behind the church to where they couldn't be seen from the road nor the house when he pulled in the park that night. But he was actually followed over there by Officer Galloway, who parked his car out on the side of the road. And after he went in the house, came down and stood outside and listened. A lot of my uncles and cousins, I think it was like two or three detectives were standing outside, had their guns drawn on him the whole time he was in our living room, because the curtains were open to where they could see through the windows about what was going on. And of course, when my dad called him up to come over, he had to have a talk with him. He came over with his .45. In a shoulder holster concealed in his jacket because he had suspected that my dad had found out. So he did show up armed. He did some directs and threats when my dad confronted him about it. And my aunt had said if he stepped in, if all she had to do was see sight of him, she wasn't going to ask any questions. She was going to shoot him. So when he went to step in the hallway to see if anybody else was in the house, my dad would tell him, you know, you better not go past that point. And he was like, why is that? You do that, it'd be the last thing you see when you see who's in that room. Well, who's in that room will go over there and take a look, and you'll see, but it'll be the last person you see. So once he realized that he was about to go to jail, you know, he was like, well, you know, you can lock me up, but you can't keep me locked up forever. They're going to let me out sooner or later. And as soon as they do, you might be able to stop me from getting to you and the rest of your children, but you will never be able to stop me at getting to Charles. I will get him. So that's pretty much when my dad told him he better get out that front door. Everybody that was outside was wondering why he didn't shoot him then. But he walked out into police custody. He was taken to the Cobb County Jail, booked in. They went over there, and they picked up his wife. They turned around and charged her, too. Ed Sr. wound up with the custody of their children.
That's horrible.
It is. They put her in Georgia Regional. For mental health evaluation, which is very logical because the woman was very, very, very much needed, you know, mental help from that point.
Right.
But him, Ed got him an attorney. About 60 days later, wound up getting him a bond, posted a property bond, and got him out of jail. And my dad got a phone call that he had been released from jail. So my dad called the DA's office, and they was like, well, we can only sentence him so many years, and he will, once he's sentenced, he'll be out in 3 years. Well, that wasn't something my dad wanted to hear. So he called some of his friends that were attorneys, and they told him that it would be kind of hard to make him really serve a lot of time in prison until I could get to an age to defend myself. So there was two brothers that he knew that were builders that built houses with him. They were from Morganton, Georgia. They knew two cattle ranches that were for sale. He could buy one and move us on one, have another one. So in the event he were to find us, he could take us to the other ranch, keep us over there until he could deal with the problem. And that's what he wound up doing. Just went up and bought two ranches. He bought my mom a brand new automobile. This is 73 Oldsmobile Regency with a triple maroon package. Beautiful car. And that was her new automobile. He traded in her 71 or 72 Delta 88 and got her a Regency. And so he wouldn't know the new automobile. And I stayed at my grandmother's house until the end of the school year. Then he just went ahead and moved us up to Fannin County. So he was having to drive, when he came home, it was 86 miles, like in one direction, or 89 miles. Yeah, 89 miles in one direction from, you know, my grandmother's house to the ranch where we lived at. So, through his arrest, I had my second near-death experience and my second bout of double pneumonia. And that's why I do believe in God, and I do believe in the one we call Jesus, because if it wasn't for that, who knows what kind of individual I would have grown up to become myself, having a brother that wound up joining this organization.
Right.
So,
absolutely.
So we got there, and I got to play my first year of baseball, but I had to play for the Mineral Bluff Elementary School because they didn't have enough students at their school to have a ball team. So I had to play baseball for another elementary school, even though I attended there at Morganton. And, of course, in 1974, the baseball game between Morganton Elementary and Murphy Elementary up there in North Carolina, which is the next county up from Fannin, I accused Francis Cook, the owner of Murphy Builder Supply, oldest son Mike Cook, of going to blow up a federal building out in Oklahoma City that wasn't even built until 3 years later.
How old were you then?
The Olympics. I was around 8. Mike was 9, and he did, in fact, do exactly what I accused him of going to do at that ball game. He did engage in the attack of the Alfred P. Murray Federal Building, and he is actually the bomber of the Centennial Park, not Eric Rudolph. Eric Rudolph just built the explosives. He wasn't the one who set them out.
That was the one for the Olympics in Atlanta, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yes, ma'am. That's why a lot of people can pull up there to Blue Ridge over there by the Waffle King and start asking about stuff like this, and they'll find out this stuff is common knowledge up there. They can do the same thing in Murphy, North Carolina at the Waffle King up there. It's all common knowledge. But anyway, I think that's how it was easier for him to locate us because, you know, Ed was tied in with that much. And Danny Hughes, I remember when we played the second ball game with Murphy that year, my dad treated everybody to the Tasty Freeze, both teams. So the people from Murphy got to get free food and drinks. With, you know, people from Morganton, I think he spent like $600 that one night, everybody in there eating. That was the first time I saw Danny Hughes in my life, and he wasn't but maybe 16 years old, and he was kind of creepy to me then, just like he is creepy to me today. And that's the traitor that matches up to the composite sketch of the homicide of 12-year-old Patrick Balthazar of the Atlanta child murders.
Oh, man. But he's never got arrested for
it? No, ma'am. He got arrested in 2015 when he shot and killed my buddy, 44-year-old Terry Owenby. He had accused Terry back in October of 96 of getting one of his nieces strung out on drugs, which Terry always denied. We were in Waffle King one evening having coffee. Terry became a coffee drinking buddy of mine. And he approached us and was accusing me of being a federal agent. And accused Terry of being getting one of his nieces strung out on dope, and said it didn't matter how long it would, one of these days he would kill him. And he did in 2015. Terry was driving out Highway 74 from Murphy out to the Copper Basin area when his automobile struck a culvert in the road and damaged his car, and he pulled up into King's Lettercraft. Was waiting on a wrecker to come out and tow his vehicle. A couple of his buddies was there. Some words were exchanged between him and Danny, and Daddy just pulled out a gun and shot him right there and killed him. He was acquitted in 2021, a second-degree murder. But the state of North Carolina can still go back in and charge him with first-degree murder. Mm-hmm.
I got some questions for you here.
Ma'am?
I got some questions for you here, too.
Okay.
What year did you start advocating against child abuse?
Latter part of 1988
and 1989. And what brought you to do that?
Well, there was this company called Star Enterprises. They used to do fundraising for different charity organizations. We had done work for the 1989 Bulletproof Vest Program for the Cherokee County Sheriff's Department. And they had this project up in Chattanooga, Tennessee, for this awareness magazine for child abuse publishing, and wanted me to go up there and do some work on getting up the rest of the money to get this magazine produced up in Chattanooga. So I got involved in that and got to reading up on the literature. So I wanted to set up this program with the Cobb County Schools to educate the PTA and the teachers about, you know, the signs and symptoms of child abuse and the various forms of child abuse at that, including sexual abuse. So Ward got over there to Ed Bentley Sr. that I was out advocating and educating people about child abuse, and I had threats toward me about it.
So would you say that Bentley Farms is associated with child trafficking and also with high-profile missing children?
I have no choice but to corroborate that. Because to my understanding, up until recent months, that they were still using this barn that was there on North Marietta Parkway past Roswell Road. And it's like I was talking with a couple 3 nights ago about it. A lot of people have ridden out through that stretch of road right there, and they've always seen this barn on the side of the road that was all the time catching on fire but never burned down. The lot in that barn would catch on fire, you know, according to the Bentleys, was from vandals. But there's nobody going on Bentley Farm without Ed Bentley knowing it. And that just does not happen. It is too well guarded, too well watched. They're the ones going over there burning that lot to destroy forensic evidence. I found this out in 1991. Out of John Ramsey's oldest daughter, Beth Ramsey, and her boyfriend, Matt Darrington. Because what had happened, Jim Stubbs, he had found us up in Morganton in 1975. He got up there to Morganton, started asking some of the local people around the area where we lived at. My dad found out. He bought a passenger van, sent us to the other ranch, and just kept me there with him at the one where we regularly lived at. When he knew he showed up, was going to show up, he had me there. He had moved his Traco that Jim had operated on one of his developments up there to his farm, so he would see that he found the right place. Officer Galloway was taking him out. That day he left Marietta. He followed him all the way up Highway 5 to 76, all the way out to Morganton Elementary, parked his car on the other side of the school where Jim couldn't see him. When he parked his car right there at the turnoff of Lovin Road, and he followed him behind that old house that used to stand there and behind people's houses all the way over to our ranch, to the wooded area at our ranch. There was this old roadbed where the creek fed out, where he went and was hiding out at and stalking our house while Bill Galloway was watching him. So Bill was able to sneak around to the back patio door without him seeing him and notified my dad that he was there. He didn't even have a chance to stop and contact command, because when they stopped and got gas, he couldn't make it to a payphone and call without being noticed. So right. He couldn't communicate with command at all. So he was pretty much on his own to follow him all the way from Cobb County up to Fannin County. Well, our ranch hand, Johnny, was also our bus driver. He didn't have any children, but he and his wife, Nora Lee, that they're on the ranch in a little cottage by us, two-bedroom cottage. So they all took position and had me to walk up the apple orchard in the rear pasture past the creek that fed out into our two-acre pond in the back pasture. And that's when he came out of the hiding, and he came up and he approached me. And he pulled his gun to shoot me. And they warned him not to pull his gun on me, but it was really suicide by cop, really. His last words was he was going to teach me a lesson that I was not supposed to open my mouth about certain things, because he could not go to prison for the crimes that he committed, because he might not would survive in prison. So that's when he lifted his gun to shoot.
And he didn't care nothing now, about the kids. He didn't care anything about the kids who he harmed and killed and all the different people like that, but he just cared about himself.
Yeah, I mean, I can't understand. How are you going to teach someone a lesson if you're going to kill them? I mean,
yeah.
Especially a 9-year-old boy. Well, this was during the summer, and so school was out. But everybody in that area knew that he came over there and was killed. Everybody knew it. Because in those little towns and places like that, word travels fast. Well, before they shot him, I turned my back because I didn't want to see him shot.
Right.
So I was at school, and some of my classmates had asked me, what happened to this guy? Because, you know, his car was parked there for like over a week before the sheriff's department found it abandoned. So, of course, Joe Kirby, who was sheriff at the time, was, you know, missing person from Cobb County. His car's found there in, you know, Morganton. You know, he has to investigate, you know, being sheriff. So they got some of the classmates to get out of me exactly what happened. Well, they asked me, some of them asked me if he came. I was like, well, yeah, well. Did he try to kill you? Well, yeah. Well, did you see it? Well, no, I turned my back. Well, that's not what the sheriff heard. So, next thing we know, they're showing up with a little rubber tire backhoe and trying to dig him up. And my dad had buried this dead cow 13 feet over him, 6 feet deep, with that traco, because Officer Galloway told him, you know, they could still try to build a case against him for bringing that traco up there. Well, if it would have been Cobb County, they would have, but not Fannin County. Fannin County would have been, well, heck yeah. You know, best way to deal with it. You know, but not Cobb. Cobb would be like, if you had no business, well, my dad's defense would have been, well, I had a right to do work on my on my farm with my track hoe if I want to. You can't tell me what I can or cannot do, and still Cobb County wouldn't have had a case. But they would have tried. My dad did not want to fork the money and the heartache and the headache of having to deal with a grand jury indictment, having to defend himself in court, you know, and him a developer builder. So he just made the spur of the moment decision. He told Bill Galloway, hey, if they fire you at the police department, you'll work for me. I'll pay you good. You know, Bill couldn't argue with that. So they buried him almost 20 feet deep. I mean, my daddy buried him deep. He's still buried there, by the way. So when they got out there and they dug up those bones from that dead cow, though, they thought they found something. They come down there to the house and they told my dad, the detective did, well, we found some bones up there, so we think we found something. And my dad was like, oh, where'd you dig at? How deep did you dig? So when he told him, he goes, oh, you dug up an old cow bone and you think you found something. And he goes, I thought you meant you found a human bone or something. No, you just went up there and dug up a few cow bones and you thought you found something, which of course I didn't sit too good with Joe Kirby once that detective walked back up there and told him. He came back down there to the house with him and he told him, we're taking your son up here and we're going to ask him some questions. Well, my dad couldn't tell him no, so they did. We got up there where they dug up some of the bones of the dead cow, and that man, he looked at me, he said, all right, boy, where is he? I just looked at him and said, why should I tell you if you're going to try to send my daddy to prison? And he goes, well, it'd be one thing if he showed up here and pointed a gun at you and was about to shoot you than just showing up here and your daddy shooting him. I said, well, that's what happened. He pointed his gun at me to shoot me. Oh, really? And exactly what did he say before he did? So I told him. And then he goes, well, why didn't you see it? I said, I didn't want to see him shot. I turned my back right then. And he was like, you mean when he pulled his gun to shoot you is when you turned your back? I said, yes, sir. That detective, he was a very distinguished-looking gentleman. He just shook his head, and he looked at me. And he goes, Charles, just don't take that we're over here trying to arrest your dad. We're just trying to get to the truth. And because he's got family down in Marietta wanting to know the truth. I have an 8-year-old daughter myself, and I'm a deputy sheriff. I would be able to deal with a situation different than what your daddy did. Tell you what, somebody came up here under those circumstances, I would have to shoot them too. Sheriff Kirby was like, yeah, my son, he's 12, almost 13. Someone was to show up like that and that, I'd have to kill him too. Now, I would have done it a little different on the disposing of the body, but your daddy's not going to prison. Your daddy didn't do anything I wouldn't have done myself. And he looked over that tractor operator. He goes, bury up that dead cow, get that thing loaded up, let's get out of here. DA did try to get him for, desecration of a corpse or something like that, some minor charge, and the grand jury would not indict. So that cleared it up.
Right.
He did wind up hiring another ranch hand because after that, Johnny and Norley wound up moving over by her daddy's house. My dad bought them a brand new single wide they could live in by her daddy up near Union County. I went and visited with her a couple of years ago. She couldn't remember me, but She's still alive, but Johnny, he died back in 76, 77 from cancer. Tore me up. The guy he hired after that, he had a daughter my age. They moved in the cottage, and we were not allowed to communicate with his daughter. And he was sexually abusing my older brother, Fred. So when he got arrested.
So that's how Fred ended up getting involved in the shenanigans and stuff, right?
Well, I wouldn't say at that point. I think he started getting involved in 1979 after we had moved back down here because once word got to Ed Sr., he filed a wrongful death suit against my dad in 76. He expected my dad to pay the state of Georgia the money to go up there and do a forensic recovery of the body of Jim Stubbs, which was well over $100,000 back then. My dad goes, well, if you want him dug up, I'll take my track hoe up there and I'll dig him up for you. Oh, no, no, no. It's going to be forensic. You're going to pay child support for the children. And when they graduate, you're going to supply them the transportation and college tuition. My dad was like, hell, you say. So, of course, Bentley lost the lawsuit. My dad turned around and he countersued. I forgot how much money he got toward the purchase of the ranch that we lived on, which he turned around and sold it to the son of the gentleman we bought it from. Of course, that's where Damon lives today, logger over there in Blue Ridge. To my understanding, Jim Stubbs still remains buried there on the old Davenport farm today. So in 1996, I was supposed to receive 6 acres, a house habitable with working appliances, and $450,000 to be paid by August the 1st. So in 1991, I had left working at Waffle House over there at Unit 479, and I had went to work with my uncle, Morris Veach, over selling Kirby vacuum cleaners out in Athens, Georgia. And I eventually wound up moving out there and becoming a field counselor, which was a sales manager for Chandler Enterprise, the Kirby vacuum distributorship back then. So it was very rare for me to come back to Marietta. I had popped in time to time and visited with the staff that I had worked with at the Waffle House, and but I was very, very busy. Very rarely did I come back to Marietta. It was either the last part of August into early part of September after witnessing a restaurant owner out in Paul, Georgia, lose his life on a motorcycle hitting a cow one night out there. My boss wanted me to take a 2-week vacation because that was the second time that I actually saw somebody killed. And it's just one of those experiences I just do not like to see someone die. It's not one of the experiences that I really cherish. So I wound up becoming a witness against the police department for a homicide of an East Cobb woman. Cheryl Underwood, who also went by Chris Miller.
Oh.
And she was a victim of sex trafficking. Sergeant Glenn Turner, the one that died from ethylene glycol by his wife, Lynn Turner, was involved in that homicide. They did not discover her body until 1992, where they had buried her at off of Scuffle Grit Road. But it was the Rat Pack, the members of the 4th Precinct, who murdered her. Well, I had picked up an automobile from an old friend of mine I used to work on automobiles with, little Mazda 626. And when I got back to Athens, it had an oil leak that needed to be fixed, so I had to bring it back to Marietta, back to Gene, and have him fix it. So Gene had this 71 Cutlass convertible he would let me use time to time, so that's what I was driving. I decided to ride back over to the Waffle House, visit with, you know, people I'd worked with, see what they've been up to. And they was telling me about this, you know, young, pretty woman that had been coming in for like the past little over 3 months looking for me. It wasn't on a daily basis, but, you know, about 4 or 5 times in a 3-month period, she had come to that Waffle House asking about me. She had left her pager number every time she came in. One time she came in with her boyfriend asking about me. So when they were telling me about this woman coming in the Waffle House asking about me, I was like, well, I think someone, you know, would be coming out trying to recruit me in to be a celebrity or something. I'm beginning to wonder if it was an ex-girlfriend or woman looking for me, you know, for some ungodly reason. I was clueless. You know, why would this world, you know.
Y'all pay close attention. This goes into the next saga of some important names that y'all will know.
Yeah. Well, I had missed her by 30 minutes. So they wound up paging her. She was going by Beth Jones. I couldn't place who a Beth Jones was. She arrived in a little blue Geo, which belonged to her friend Paula. And it was John Ramsey's oldest daughter, Beth Ramsey. So I went out and sat in her automobile.
But she's got a different mother than JonBenet.
Yes, ma'am. Lucy or Lucinda is her mother's name. Her siblings is John Andrew and Melanie Ramsey. Burke and JonBenet are her half-siblings.
Yes.
Well, what had happened was she was a stewardess for Delta Airlines. She also had a part-time job at a bar up in Chicago where she worked as a cocktail waitress. So she was the stewardess on the airlines that served the drinks, the beer, and alcohol and stuff. And she said after Burke was born, she came and visited with her dad and Patsy and Marietta, you know, just to be able to meet him. And she would pop in time to time and visit with her dad and her stepmother. But when JonBenet was born and she came out and she got to hold her for the first time, her heart just melted. When she got to hold him. So after that, coming around her daddy more often. But before that, she had really been alienated before the birth of Burke because she had been sexually abused by John since she was 7 years of age.
Wow.
Until her mother found out in 1978. And with the help of John's dad, Jay Ramsey, was able to get out of Marietta. I think it was Virginia or some state like that they went to before they went to Illinois.
So he got away scot-free from that, away from that, huh? Well, that had to face repercussions?
Yes, ma'am. The reason why she told her mother was, according to her, started out one day she had on a dress or something. He wound up sticking his hand up her dress. And then after that, it got more than just touching. And she didn't want to go into the details, but Matt, when I met him the next day, he just pretty much laid it out. You know, John had actually sexually assaulted her numerous occasions. But when he had done that to Melanie, stuck his hand up her dress, that's when she went and told her mother. Well, him and her started out.
Right?
Yes, ma'am. And that's, John had already had some affairs on her. And the people in Marietta and Atlanta that he associated with, Lucy just was not that fond of. She just didn't care for the people in Atlanta. And you cannot blame her. You know, these people are some of the worst, what I call filthy rich scum that has ever hit this planet. And that's the
Java
type of crowd that's on.
But when Java Day was murdered, it was in Colorado, I believe, right?
Yes, ma'am. That was just one of the homes that the Ramseys had, was the one in Boulder. They had a home at East Cobb at one point. Then they wound up purchasing a home in Sandy Springs, less than 3 miles from John Mark Carr's dad. Because John Ramsey and John Carr's dad are good close friends.
So does John Bonet, I mean, does John Ramsey and these other people, Bentley Farms, are they affiliated with each other?
Well, yes, ma'am. That barn was always their base of operations. It's not the only place like that. They have them scattered out through the country. Now, where these other locations are is beyond me, but I know about Bentley Farm. When she was visiting with her daddy, she got to overhear one of his phone conversations one night because she was sitting outside the room of his study watching television, and the door was partially open while he was having a telephone conversation, and my name came up. And what had happened was they determined they did not want to honor the settlement from 1978 because they did not want to give up any of the land over there on Bentley Farm. So what they did was they bribed my older brother to get rid of me, and they would just give him the $450,000.
Yeah, that's Fred, right?
Yes, ma'am. Well, my first encounter with John Ramsey was around 3 days before my 18th birthday in 1983. Fred and his best friend, Roger Nance, they had taken graphics and art design back in high school. In Walton High School, the students from Wheeler had to go over there for geometry. The ones who wanted to study arts and graphics had to go over to Wheeler and take a class over there. So Fred, he graduated in class of 82, and so did Roger. So in 1981, my dad got him a 1978 Nova Ogets pest control car, two-door, as his first arrived six-cylinder, and that was Fred's first form of transportation. So he was all the time at that point going picking up Roger, and they were doing things, running back and forth to school, between the schools and stuff like that, till they graduated. So after they were initiated in 1982 during the sacrifices of two black children down at the Chattahoochee River, there where the Canoe Restaurant is located today, is the sacrificial site of the Atlanta child murders.
Yeah, they said that is that located anywhere where they used to have those stoves that they were talking about in Atlanta?
No, those are in Elberton, Georgia. Those are the Georgia Guidestones.
Yeah, the Guidestones. Yeah, that's where I was. Yes, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's in Elberton, Georgia, the granite capital of the world.
Oh, okay.
And they're the same people that destroyed them, and they intend to build a new set to start the new Reign of Terror.
So to get back where you were with Beth Ramsey, she went ahead and contacted you because of her daddy mentioning your name, right? That's why she got with you?
Yes, ma'am. They determined to pay. If Fred could help them get rid of me, they would pay him the $450,000. So when she reintroduced herself as Beth Ramsey, she asked me if I'd ever heard of the John Ramsey, and I said the only John Ramsey that I can think of was the John Ramsey I met over here at Layton Graphics that was trying to kill me before my 18th birthday back in 1983. And she goes, yeah, that's my dad. Now, you talking about scared at when I first got engaged with a conversation with this young lady. I mean, she really scared me there at one point because she started talking about Jim Stubbs and what had happened to Jim Stubbs. She knew all that. And I only had shared that with only a select few of my friends. I just did not go out running my mouth to people I went to school with. That was just one of those things that I just kept to myself. And the last thing in the world I wanted to do was humiliate my older brother and go out and tell people what had happened to him in 1976 with Bart Taylor. I never mentioned that until 2018 when I found out that my brother was out there telling people that I was put in the tub with all three children and they were doing all kinds of things to me, which was a lie. He knew better. But I was just among the lies that he and his colleagues were putting out on me. They even was telling people at one point I'd went and stole a bunch of stuff from this one guy who was a drug dealer and turned around and got him busted. They had been telling people right after I got out of high school that I was homosexual or bisexual. And they should have known better. I did have girlfriends. And that came out when everybody started seeing I had girlfriends. They were like, well, something's not right. If he's gay, what's he doing with a girlfriend? And they're like, well, he's bisexual. Well, what's he doing hanging out with straight guys? Because all the guys that I was hanging out with, they were straight. So it didn't take them long to figure out that that was a lie. But still, I mean, the humiliation, it's just, you know, what these people will say and do and all that. It's just, you know, totally amazing how cold-hearted they can be against somebody that, you know, really is innocent of anything. I mean, I did not ask for this. I was 6 years old. And all these years I've been told, well, you had no business dragging yourself into this. So I didn't drag myself into anything.
No, it's not your fault what the perpetrators did to you.
No, I did not just jump up one day in the 1990s to say that I was going to go out and stop 26 out of 31 terrorist attacks and get a hydrogen bomb surrendered to the ATF on the night of the 28th of January, 1998. No, I just didn't just jump up in the 1990s and thought that I was just going to go do my civic duty. I was dragged into this mess. The same people who dragged me into this mess when I was 6 years of age are the people responsible for the Oklahoma City, the Centennial Park attack, and all these other
Atlanta
terrorist
murders
attacks.
And all that, huh?
Yes, ma'am. And this is what I got out of Beth and Matt the next day when I actually got to meet him. Is he got to doing some of his own investigation into her dad and her granddad. And that is how I originally found out about the North Fox Island pedophile ring over there with the Brother Paul summer camp. Was through Matt Darrington. This is when I found out their plots going to conduct these terrorist attacks in the United States to start this race war and civil war to abolish the United States government to usher in their new world order. Because the way Matt and Beth looked at it is they would much rather be dead than to live under the reality of being governed by a group of elite pedophiles. And that was their take on it. She would much rather die trying to stop this than knowing that her little half-sister would be raised by the likes of her daddy. She did not have a lot of confidence in Patsy, because Patsy, she was one of those mothers that to her was irresponsible, that was all up into John's friends and right up there, you know, what she called the brown noser of these people. And she just did not have any confidence in Patsy whatsoever. The her ultimate goal was...
I'm going to let you know we got about 10 minutes left.
Oh, okay. But her ultimate goal was to get her daddy and that bunch busted to where she could raise JonBenet herself. Well, what it happened...
She wanted to help her...
Yeah, she wanted to raise JonBenet.
Yeah, she had a threat of what John was going to do to the with JonBenet, right?
Yes, ma'am. What had happened during the 3.5 months that they were searching for me, they were going to alert me about the contract that they had put out on me. And there had been a little girl that they had been holding over there on Bentley Farm, Caucasian girl, and they were not able to rescue. So I'm thinking this was around September the 17th, if I can remember correctly, when I made contact with her, and then the day after that with Matt. They had two black teenagers, boys over there that they were holding. One was 15 years old from Orlando, Florida area, just east of Orlando. Another one was over from Birmingham, and both of them were in foster care. So they were not reported as missing. They were being held over there on that barn, on Bentley Farm. I did not even have time to try to make any contacts with any of my cousins or friends or anything to even try to rescue them. So she decided she was deliberating whether she would go and confide with John Andrew or not. And Matt and I, we told her not to. not to breathe a word to any of her siblings. That would be a big mistake, because more than likely John Andrew would tell their daddy. And if her daddy found out, we could get killed while trying to rescue those two teenagers. So we thought that she would not tell John Andrew. So we met over there that night with her friend Paula, because when I met with her and Matt, they was in his black Beamer. Beth was going to be at the Eastgate Shopping Center in her little Chevrolet Geo. Matt and Beth was going to be in Matt's BMW right there behind the Waffle House. I was to go in the barn, which I did, and free the two boys' nursery up behind the BP gas station across Greenbrier Parkway. Put one in the car with her, and her and Matt was going to rush them over to this place by the American Legion off of South Marietta Parkway. Today was Clay Street back then. And Beth and I was going to take the other boy, okay, to the first precinct, the Cobb County Police Department. That way, one of them would definitely be rescued, and we would be able to take down this terrorist organization then. Well, she told John Andrew.
Uh-oh.
I get the two boys free, convince them they're going to be fine. I'm there to rescue them. We get out, and we rush up through the poison oak down into the gully up behind Pike Nursery. We run up, Matt's in the woods there when we approach. Everything seems to be fine. We go running up. And right when we run across Greenbrier Parkway, I hear what was like a bumblebee fly by my head and two boys dropping on the pavement. They shot and killed the two teenagers.
Oh, boy.
Judge
they never
McLaughlin,
had to pay for it.
No, Judge McLaughlin was there. I'm just sitting there dazed. I'm like, I can't believe what I just saw. I was wondering why I was still alive. Lee comes walking up to me, and he goes, well, Charles, since you got yourself involved with this, those records on your court settlement over here about Bentley Farm are going to be destroyed. And you better not breathe a word to your daddy, will kill him. But we found out today that you were going to be involved in this, so we're going to destroy those records. Her daddy's going to be here shortly, and he's got something he wants to say to you, too. John arrived. And what had happened between John and me was when I met him in 1983 at Layton Graphics. I was being told I was going to meet one of the guys involved in the Atlanta child murders. I did not want to meet him, but I had just got my automobile. My brother was driving my automobile. I was passenger of my automobile. Just got it that day, the 77 Grand Prix. So I wound up meeting this guy there at Layton Graphics, and we stepped out across the road to where we could talk without being on cameras, on the security cameras outside. And I got to sit there and listen to him boast and brag about the children he had murdered. And when he sat there and talked about shooting Jill Robinson in the face with a shotgun up there in Oakland County, everybody else but me were sitting there laughing like that stuff was funny. I couldn't believe what I was witnessing out of my older brother. I couldn't believe it. This was the type of conduct that I would expect out of him when he was wanting me to fight somebody. When I was growing up, that's what he would do, because he'd know I'd fight somebody that would talk about doing something to a child. He knew that. And he should have known then that's the way I was going. I mean, I was still 17, but I was a scrapper. And I would have had no problem fighting John Ramsey at 17 years of age.
Hey, we might have to leave it at this. Remember where we left off, and we take up next Sunday?
Yeah, we can do that. Just remind me about the 11-year-old blonde up in West Virginia that kicked his butt and got away, and we'll take it up from there.
Yeah, go ahead and tell that story about the, so we can leave it on a positive note right there.
Okay. Anyway, Roger asked him about happened with this girl that got away. And remember correctly, it's West Virginia, he said, where it was. I don't remember what part it was. But he found her at an ice cream parlor. So he lured her to his automobile by buying her ice cream and offering to take her for a ride around town.
About how old was she?
So, 11.
Okay.
So he drives her out to a secluded location out in this field on the base of a mountain, got her out into the backseat of the car, and proceeded in trying to sexually assault her, but he failed to remove her tennis shoes. Because he failed to remove her tennis shoes, she was able to gain her footing, not only on the floorboard and on the seat, but against his family jewels, too. So she managed to fight him and beat him off and escape.
I love that. Now
so he had his friends up in... Yeah, so he had his friends
seconds.
In Washington. Huh?
Now we got 45 seconds left, 40 seconds.
Okay, well, I'm not going to have time to tell the rest of the story, so I'll give everybody something to elaborate on until the next time I'll finish the rest of the story, and that'll give them something else to laugh about, because John Ramsey got his butt kicked by an 11-year-old blonde.
Yes, yeah, she got away from John Ramsey. She did not end up murdered. Well, thank you so much for coming in and sharing the story, and we'll see you next Sunday, okay?
All right. Thank you for having me on your program.
Well, thank you. Bye-bye.